Welcome, everybody. Good morning, and welcome to our panel on Sister Wives Goes to Court. This is panel number 215 for Sunstone, and a couple of brief reminders before we get started. The first is, as you will hear throughout the day, please take your cell phones and turn off all of the wonderful musical ringtones that you have so that we have an ability to give the presentations without musical interruption. We are going to also ask that, and I'll mention this again at the end of the talks, we're going to have a period of about 20 minutes for audience question and answers. I will ask that you keep your question to 2 minutes or less if you have a particular question. So I recognize that a lot of you may have questions, but we want to keep it we want to keep the microphone open for other folks to ask questions as well. So when we get to that point, if you start talking too much in your question, I may have to, yes. So other things to mention, we do have that there are a number of other sessions dealing with related issues. There is a polygamy, that Newell's book, which is going to be discussed later today, I believe is the, tomorrow. So if it's a topic which is of interest to you, absolutely take a look at the Sunstone program and take a look at the related panels as well. And at this point, what I'm going to do is introduce our panelists. So I will be the first speaker. My name is Ki'imi Wenger. I'm associate professor of law. I was just promoted. I was assistant professor when I sent my bio in. So associate professor of law at Thomas Jefferson Law School in San Diego, California. Much of my research deals with civil rights topics, which is how I became interested in these cases. And I've also written on Proposition 8 and legal issues there, and there are some interesting overlaps. Our second panelist is going to be Ben Winslow, a multimedia journalist for Fox 13 News. He has experimented with new technologies and has been a pioneer in that field, disseminating news stories across multiple platforms. And he covers many of Utah's biggest news stories, including many cases relating to polygamy. Ben Winslow also volunteers on the board of Utah Headliners Chapter of the Society of Professional Journalists. Ben will be followed by, we will have Duane Hafen. Duane is an unaffiliated practicing polygamist based in Mexico with a family history of polygamy and a very interesting set of ties to the community. And he will be discussing ways in which the lawsuit is viewed or could impact the the polygamist community in general, outside of the particulars of any sect or particular group. And finally, Cheryl Bruno, who is a mainstream, the labels are always difficult. Cheryl is a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, often referred to as the mainline or mainstream LDS church. I don't mean that in a derogatory way towards members of other groups. But Cheryl will be talking about, again, social consequences or potential repercussions of the lawsuit from the perspective of the Salt Lake-based LDS church. So I apologize in advance if I use any labels in any way which is exclusionary or harmful. I don't intend to do so. It is hard to discuss this sometimes without using those sorts of labels. All right, so on that note, let's talk about, well, we'll start with a poll. A couple of years ago, I did this. I polled the room, and at Sunstone, it was very interesting. So if you are in the state of Utah, and the state of Utah is bringing a criminal prosecution for bigamy, and that you are to be convicted, how many people would you have to be married to in order to be convicted of bigamy in the state of Utah? How many people think it would be two or more that you need to be married to? A reasonable enough assumption. How many think you need to be married to one person in order to be convicted of bigamy? How many think you would need to be married to zero? You'd need to be married to zero. If you were married to more than one, you could be convicted, but you don't have to be married to anyone in the state of Utah to be convicted of bigamy. Utah has an incredibly broad statute The Utah Criminal Code, Section 76, 7101, a person is guilty of bigamy when, knowing he has a husband or wife, knowing the other person has a husband or wife, the person purports to marry another person or cohabits with another person. That is, Utah has an unlawful cohabitation prong. You don't need a second wife or husband to be convicted of bigamy in Utah. In fact, you don't need to be married to anyone. If you meet somebody, this seems like a great person to have a relationship with, she is legally married to someone else, but they're separated, and you move in with your new girlfriend, you are, under the Utah statute, committing bigamy. Why is that? It goes to the specifics of the Mormon legal prosecutions in the 1800s. That is, the federal government was very interested in stopping the practice of plural marriage, and this led to a number of different statutes. We get the Morrill Act. The Morrill Act, of course, says you are not allowed to be married to more than one person. This turns out this is very difficult to enforce. First off, because records were not kept in many cases, so there would be a marriage, but there would not be the legal documentation of it. How do you prove it in court? You're saying that I'm a polygamist? Prove it. You're the federal government. Where's the records? A second thing is that this would go to juries. Bigamy is a felony, and so this would go to a jury, and the Mormon juries would refuse to convict under a practice called jury nullification, where even if you think that the person is guilty, you believe that the law is unjust, and so you don't convict. This leads to an important legal change in the Edmunds Act in 1882, and this finally allows for effective enforcement. They create the crime of unlawful cohabitation. This removes the necessity of showing marriage records for a second marriage. All you have to do is show that someone is married to one person and has cohabited with someone else. And they made it a misdemeanor instead of a felony, which took it away from the jury. It only had a 6-month sentence, but then they would, as soon as you got out of prison for your misdemeanor, they would haul you back into court, say, are you still violating the law? Another 6-month sentence, another 6-month sentence. So it ended up being an incredibly effective way to legally prosecute people who were practicing plural marriage in Utah, which hadn't been done under the prior statutes. Sally Gordon's book, which discusses the legal claims against polygamy, documents that between 1882 and 1893, there were 31 convictions under the bigamy statute and 1,004 under the unlawful cohabitation statute. This is really the statute which was used to suppress plural marriage in the 1800s, and it's still on the books. It's still on the books in Utah and in Idaho. No other jurisdictions have the unlawful cohabitation problem. So this brings up the next question. Well, you might know somebody who is, you know, they've moved in with their new girlfriend or boyfriend who is still legally married to someone else as they're sorting out the messy divorce. Do you need to call the cops? No. In fact, the Utah AG has said, for the most part, we are not going to prosecute consenting adult violations of the statute. And so there were a number of raids when you go back decades, but these have been incredibly unpopular politically because journalists are taking pictures of little babies being separated from their mommies. Everybody says, what's going to happen to the babies now? It becomes this incredibly difficult sort of case to prosecute. And so as a result, the Utah AG has said and has had an agreement, we're not going to go after consenting adult polygamy. And in fact, when you look at the cases that are in the news, when you look at the Warren Jeffs case, which is in the news, Warren Jeffs is not being charged with polygamy. He's being charged with accessory to child rape. And this is, you don't see people charged with polygamy in general today unless they're engaged in child abuse, unless they're engaged in welfare fraud or other sorts of legal violations. So there's been an understanding that the Utah AG and the Arizona AG are not going to go after these individuals in consenting adult relationships. So this raises a couple of questions. From here, let's skip to gay marriage for a second, or rather to gay rights in general. A few years ago, and in fact less than a decade ago, the United States Supreme Court finally strikes down a set of deeply anti-gay laws known as anti-sodomy laws in Lawrence versus Texas. these were also unenforced for decades, but because they were unenforced, the court said, we're not going to mess with them. That is, courts can only engage in review. U.S. federal courts, bound by Article 3 of the Constitution, can only review cases that are actually being brought, not hypothetical cases. That's the very brief version of the legal doctrine of standing. If you take your civil procedure class in law school, you'll spend a semester on it. But the very brief version is you have to have an actual case before the court gets involved. This was actually a problem for gay rights advocates who for years wanted to overturn anti-sodomy laws, but there were no prosecutions. And it wasn't until a deeply homophobic cop in Texas arrested a couple of adults who were gay men engaged in a sex act that the court said, we're striking this down. Lawrence versus Texas contains language indicating that people have a right to intimate association, they have a right to choose who they're going to have a relationship with, and that in general, the court will not get involved unless we are doing certain really bad societal actions. And the argument has been made, and it's been made by Jonathan Turley in a recent federally filed complaint, that Cody Brown should be protected under the same sorts of legal doctrines. Again, we're going really fast over some legal doctrines. If you have questions about Lawrence, the holding, other things, we can discuss them in Q&A, but we're going really fast over some of this. At this point, we need to talk about a few other legal concepts. The first is the difference between formal legalization and decriminalization. So that is, it's the situation of people in plural marriages often compared to the situation of gay and lesbian individuals who are unable to marry. There are significant similarities, but there are also a major important difference, which is that if you have two gay men in Utah who decide to hold a marriage ceremony to commemorate their relationship, to bind themselves spiritually, they will not be arrested for it. The state will not give this legal recognition, but they won't be arrested for it. In contrast, if you have someone who has, again, a spiritual ceremony with a plural wife in Utah, this is a crime. And this is these people can potentially be sent to jail for it. So what the Cody Brown lawsuit is seeking is not formal legal recognition. And in fact, one of the first things which people say is, wait a minute, what happens to the taxes? What happens to insurance? What happens to community property? There are a variety of complicated potential legal consequences of formal legal recognition of polygamy. However, the Cody Brown lawsuit is rather seeking to the state to say, we will not put you in jail if you are engaged in plural marriage. And that's a different sort of attempted change in the law. From here, let me pull up my two slides. I don't have a lot of slides. But the first is someone who you may recognize who's been in the media a lot recently. and, of course, this is Hugh Hefner with his several of his young women. And then, obviously, a contrasting image is Cody Brown with his wives. And I think when we look at Hugh Hefner, we would not hold him up as a moral paragon of virtue. We would not say that this is somebody who should necessarily be emulated. But we don't think, despite his moral failings, that he should be sent to jail for having several young girlfriends. And in fact, he has his own reality show, which is about him and his girlfriends and his mansion. And I think that there's a growing sentiment that at least on the decriminalization front, that somebody who's engaged in a relationship is no more morally capable, no more morally culpable than Hugh Hefner, and should not be subject to criminal prosecution. And this is the argument which Jonathan Turley, who is a law professor at George Washington, makes in his, again, federal complaint, and a variety of legal academics have made similar arguments. There's not a lot of currently alliance between polygamist rights advocates and gay rights advocates in part, I think, because both groups are kind of scared of the other one, and gay rights advocates don't want to be called, oh, you're helping out those weird polygamists, and polygamy rights advocates are often socially conservative in ways which are less amenable to gay rights, but I think that there is a natural sort of potential alliance which says, this is part of what Louis Brandeis, the Supreme Court Justice, said, the right to be left alone. And that whether or not we approve of Cody Brown's relationship decisions, there are a lot of people, friends of mine, family members, whose relationship decisions I don't necessarily approve of, who I don't think should be sent to jail. And I think Jonathan Turley's complaint makes a rather good argument that at the very least we should not be talking about Cody Brown and the possibility of sending him to jail. Thanks.
I work for Fox 13 and here in Salt Lake City, and I have covered a lot of the stuff that's gone on here, both with the FLDS Church, a number of the independent groups, a number of the other polygamous churches in Utah, as well as the Sister Wives reality show and its lawsuit. And I'm just basically what I was asked to do was kind of give an update of what the status is. As you all know, the lawsuit was filed that talks about why they believe that they they're challenging Utah's ban on polygamy, arguing that it invades their privacy. Kind of ironic coming from someone who appears on a reality TV show, but it's a different kind of privacy. It's constitutional privacy that they're arguing, that the government is, shall we say, intruding in the bedroom, and there are rulings with the Supreme Court about the limit of government into that, most recently being Lawrence versus Texas, which is cited quite heavily in Jonathan Turley's lawsuit. We are expecting pretty much any day now the Utah Attorney General's office will file a response to the lawsuit, and then the legal motions will begin. What that response, I talked to the Attorney General the other day about it, and what that response will likely argue is standing, is first and foremost. Do the Browns have what is legally known as standing? Do they even have a right to file this lawsuit at this point? They argue that they're under a specter or a cloud of suspicion, that ever since they appeared on this reality TV show and ever since that they went public with their lives, that they have been under investigation by the Utah County Attorney's Office for bigamy. Indeed, the Utah County Attorney's Office has said, we are looking at the case. In fact, as of just a few weeks ago, that was still the status, is they remain under investigation. Whether or not, because they are openly admitting on national television to what is a felony in Utah. So, but they have yet to be charged with any crime, and it remains to be seen if they will ever be charged with any crime. So the issue is, do they even have standing to file this lawsuit? They argue, yes, Jonathan Turley told me, yes, we do. We do have standing to file this, that because they live under a constant cloud, they've had to leave the state, their relationships with other family members have been cut somewhat, they can't go to certain events that they would normally like to go to, so because of all of this, so that is why they're filing this lawsuit. The other issue that the Attorney General's office is expected to cite is numerous U.S. Supreme Court rulings and state Supreme Court rulings and federal appellate court rulings, which basically say that, yes, the state has the right to regulate marriage and define it. And as we know, Utah has Amendment 3, which is worded differently than others, which is the state shall recognize marriage as only between one man and one woman, not a man and a woman, so that you could add and a woman and a woman and a woman. That was very cleverly worded, but that is among those. And then also you have the Reynolds decision, a few other appellate court rulings, Bronson versus Swenson, which was a 10th Circuit ruling. All of these lawsuits that have been filed previously dealing with polygamy and have been struck down. The difference between a lot of the other cases that have been challenged before, polygamist Tom Green, as I'm sure you all are very familiar with, Tom Green was lived in rural Utah, was charged with child rape, criminal non-support, and bigamy. It was really one of the first of the modern-day prosecutions of polygamy. He was convicted. He served prison time. He is out now. I believe he's still on probation. The Rodney Holm case. Rodney Holm was a member of the Fundamentalist LDS Church, was convicted of unlawful sex with a minor and bigamy. Again, the state has only charged bigamy when it is in concert with other crimes, thus avoiding what some legal analysts say is a fast track to the U.S. Supreme Court on whether polygamy is a religious belief, a religious First Amendment protected religious belief. So that, and in all of the responses that the state has filed to lawsuits challenging the bigamy statute, I remember the Holm one quite distinctly saying the victim in the instant case was a minor, which is pretty much a hard hurdle to get over if you're going to challenge Utah's polygamy ban and the bigamy statutes and all of that, because you have minors. Minors can't consent, you know, under national law. But what makes the sister wives case a little different is you have all consenting adults. I believe all of the wives are in their 30s. Doesn't get much more consenting than that, you could argue. So, but their issue is can they, the first hurdle they have to clear is, can you even file a lawsuit in the first place if you haven't been charged with anything? You're seeking to overturn a criminal statute, but you're not facing anything. So it's kind of a big hurdle to clear. The last civil lawsuit that sought to challenge the ban on polygamy was Bronson versus Swenson, a family that went into the Salt Lake County Clerk's office and asked for a marriage certificate. The clerk, Sherry Swenson, said, "I'm sorry, we can't issue you one for a polygamous union." They said, "See you in court." And it went to the Tenth Circuit, but didn't go anywhere beyond that. And again, the rulings affirmed that the states have a right to define or regulate marriage, upholding it. There is one case, criminal case, pending that could potentially challenge the bigamy statutes, maybe somewhat successfully. Wendell Nielsen was the president of the Fundamentalist LDS Church for a brief time. He was charged in connection with the Texas raids, and he is facing only a bigamy charge. And it is not for any kind of child bride marriage, unlike Warren Jeffs and a lot of the others who have been charged. He's facing a straight-up bigamy. If the state of Texas decides to pursue that prosecution, there could potentially be an argument for a First Amendment religious-protected belief. We'll see where that goes. Warren Jeffs, as you know, was convicted yesterday in Texas of child sex assault. He also faces a bigamy trial in October, but it would likely be related to underage marriages. Nielsen is kind of unique in that sense. But a lot of these cases have all involved minors in marriage. This is a situation where you have consenting adults, and Christine Brown, one of the sister wives on the reality TV show, told me before the show even started that, yes, she would like to be charged in a way if it meant decriminalizing plural marriage. You know, and that remains to be seen. And clearly, the states have had no appetite to charge bigamy straight out amongst consenting adults, and they've said that they will only charge it if there are other signs of abuse, such as underage marriages, welfare fraud, that type of thing. So far, no one has given them a lot of what they would like. A lot of these groups would like to see a test case. Wendell Nielsen could potentially be that test case. Also, the other thing that this Attorney General's office has said in the past is if you want polygamy decriminalized, go to the legislature, because it's a legislative duty. There was a push to move it to a misdemeanor, or it was briefly debated when child bigamy was made a second-degree felony in the state of Utah, but it was not included in the bill that ultimately passed, and thus far it seems that lawmakers have had no appetite. Also, haven't seen a lot of concerted push by a lot of advocates who wanted, specifically lobbying hard for it to be included, or any kind of decriminalization legislation. If there was, I don't know how far it would go on the Hill, just given the appetite with recent events with Warren Jeffs and others, if lawmakers would even touch it, because unfortunately a lot of groups get lumped together. So ultimately expect to see this to go to court, but the first hurdle, the big hurdle, again, standing, whether or not they even can file the lawsuit.
polygamist in this town. And the first question everybody wants to know, did you marry any underage girls? I have to confess that I was involved in an underage marriage. When I first married in the state of Nevada, I was under 21, and that was too young. My wife was 18, but I was 45 days short of 21, and my mother had to sign for me. So that was a legal underage marriage. My youngest wife, other than my first wife, was 20, all right? So enough of that. I want to talk about the reasons why it's against the law for me to practice plural marriage. I have a religious conviction. I follow that conviction. And as of to date, I've never been charged. And I've been pretty open about it all of my life. And the big question is, well, why is it against the law? Now, we all know it's against the law. But why? Well, back in the 1800s, the Mormon Church was practicing plural marriage, as we all know. And they decided they would put out a person to test the law, a fellow by the name of Reynolds. Well, the Supreme Court at the time wanted very, very much to convict Reynolds. They wanted to not allow polygamy. It was a social disgrace, real bad thing, this polygamy thing. So they had to come up with a reason why they could convict Reynolds. The big idea here is precedence. A precedent is something that happened before, and it serves to give continuity to the law. Now, most of us here are Mormons, and we believe that God does not lie. We believe that God is the same today, tomorrow, and forever. And that gives continuity to God. If God were to lie or change his mind, there's no God anymore. Well, that's the same way with the courts. We need continuity in the courts. We need continuity in the decisions. We can't have an arbitrary decision based on the particular whim of the day. And that's the purpose of precedence. So the precedent they chose was an obscure letter written by Thomas Jefferson, personal letter, where he basically said the government has no business in belief, but as soon as it comes to practice, then the government has a place in it. They ignored all of the writings of the principal founders of the Bill of Rights. That's James Madison, George Mason. Nobody knows who George Mason was. He's the guy that wouldn't sign the Constitution because it didn't have a Bill of Rights. All right? But he was very, very influential in the original Bill of Rights. And, of course, Thomas Jefferson wrote a lot of things. All of these things would have sustained Reynolds and let him go free based on his religion. But they chose, because of the political climate and everything else, that they were going to convict Reynolds, and they found something to stick him with. And that precedent has been with us ever since. Every time that something's brought up based on a practice, which is a religious practice, pretty much they lose. Even down to they had a case involving a young underage girl who was selling Jehovah's Witness packets, you know, those little 10-cent things that they try to give you? Well, she was selling those things, and because she was underage, they got her into a child labor law or something, and cited Reynolds. You know, her religion didn't allow her to do that. And they pretty much stuck with Reynolds. The only real time that I'm aware of that they went against it was in the 1960s, 70s. There was a group of people, Amish people, that fled to Wisconsin from other states. They actually moved to Wisconsin thinking that Wisconsin would be a better place to practice the religion, because in Iowa and Ohio and other states, they were capturing children, taking them to school, forcing them to change the way they dressed, really doing a trick on the Amish religion. Well, it turned out that Wisconsin wanted to go to school too. So they arrested and convicted and made a token fine, a very small fine, to these people. Wisconsin was a fairly liberal state, apparently. But they wanted them in school. Well, the thing went to court, not because the Amish wanted it, because some other people felt it was wrong, and they managed to get some Amish to agree to let them represent them. And they went to the Supreme Court of Wisconsin, and amazingly, the Supreme Court of Wisconsin ruled in favor of the Amish. Reynolds had been violated very much. So, what to do? Well, the state of Wisconsin appealed the decision to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court took it because they had to defend Reynolds. So, we get into this particular case, and they decided that they wanted to let the Amish win. Politically correct thing to do. So they did. They went into the writings of Madison, particularly, about forced migration and all that, and they ruled in favor of the Amish. And those of us who were living in polygamy cheered, hey, freedom of religion. Bad thought. It's not so. They went away from it, and they never went back. They continued to uphold Reynolds, still uphold Reynolds. Reynolds, we thought, was mortally wounded. He was given a Purple Heart, rehabilitated, and put right back on the front line. They love Reynolds. They keep him. Anyway, that's the particular statute, the particular precedent that is why I can't be a polygamist legally. Okay, down to the Codys. They are looking to get some help based on other precedents that have been established which allow me to look at pornography in my own home, which allow me to buy contraceptives, which allow me to do a whole lot of private things, which allow me and my boyfriend to go in the back room and do whatever we want. That is right of privacy. And the court has leaned very, very much towards equity, rights of privacy, and this sort of thing, and have basically moved away from freedom of religion. Freedom of religion will get you nowhere in the modern courts. It's a foolish to even try. The good thing about the Brown case, although they do cite some religious things there, which may be not good, they are looking to ride in on the coattails of all of these other decisions, which you and I probably looked at as, they allow what? But they allowed it. I have a right to do, I could go and line me up 3 or 4 women, as Hugh Hefner did, and we could do anything we wanted to, any time, whatever. Any permutation of any sexual act we wanted to, male, female, we don't care. Nobody would bother me. But the minute that I decide that these are my wives and I'm going to be responsible for them and I'm going to take care of them, I'm going to give them guidance, all that, I'm a criminal. There is something wrong. But we've been unable to get around it because of the Reynolds decision. We would hope that the Codys can. I personally wonder, we are in Utah. It is a federal court, but it is a Utah court. The judge who's going to hear it, University of Utah, has a law school, Brigham Young University, born in Idaho. We're Utah. And in Utah, this is going to bring embarrassment to the Mormon church. What would happen, and I think Cheryl's going to talk about this, what would happen if polygamy suddenly became legal in the state of Utah? Holy cow. The Mormon church has very much an interest in this thing not succeeding, in this case not succeeding. So personally, I suspect that this will be declared, if they'll take the case even, if they have to take the case, they're going to rule against the Codys. But maybe, just maybe, they'll do better in Colorado with the appellate court. Maybe, just maybe, they might get the Supreme Court. And if they do, they just might win. And that's about what I got to stop. Thank you.
consider what might occur among the Mormons and the LDS if polygamy is indeed decriminalized. Personally, I have some personal thoughts about all of this. I don't feel like it would appear in the beginning to affect the church much at all. We have a church that's slow to change. Members are satisfied with following modern-day prophets. But I do feel that this decision, if passed, would work on the membership, forcing us to confront specters that we've been trying to hide in our lives. Already, I've been discussing this with a lot of my friends. Among the members, and especially women, there's some fear present. Among polygamists, there's a little bit of excitement. So feelings are already starting to flare up in response to this case. Now, I'd like to discuss the fact that our leaders and historians and the members of our church, and I speak of the LDS church that I'm a member of, have constructed this quasi-official story of Mormonism and celestial plural marriage. And I want you to do a little experiment, and if I were a good Relief Society member, I'd be passing you out little index cards right now, but I'm not, so grab a scrap of paper and a pencil, anything that you have in your purse or on your computer. I'd like you to write in 3 to 5 sentences a little your conception of the official story. Include why we don't live polygamy today. The official story of polygamy, 3 to 5 sentences, and why we don't live it today. I'm only going to give you about a minute and a half. So I really want you to write it down, though. You have a writing implement.
What's the question?
The question is to write in 3 to 5 sentences the official story of polygamy in the Mormon Church, including why we don't live it today. Good exercise for you, because in 3 to 5 sentences you don't get historical details, although Mike Quinn might be able to stick something back there. You don't get the nuanced story, you just get the archetype, and that's what I want. The archetypal story of polygamy. Okay, so it looks like most of you are done with your 3 to 5. Keep going if you're not. I'm going to call on some of you to tell me what you wrote down. But let me just first tell you, this is what I wrote down, just real quick, off the top of my head. I wrote, the Lord commanded Joseph Smith to live polygamy. In the early days, it helped with logistics, like too many women or getting families across the plains. But because of laws made against plural marriage in the United States, the Lord rescinded this principle. That was my conception of polygamy as a new convert at age 19, many, many years ago. So that's my picture of what the official story is. So what's your picture? Does anyone want to share theirs?
Because politics is more important to the church than the spiritual beliefs. You wanted to become a state, you couldn't do that without giving up those principal beliefs.
Very good.
Politics would just place in the spiritual beliefs.
Good, and be real loud so everyone can hear you too. Yes.
I would say that anything that has great potential for happiness will have a commensurate potential for great misery. And that plural marriage has a tremendous potential for happiness and fulfillment, and also has that potential for great misery. Third sentence, I believe that the LDS, by the early 1890s, have proven themselves too wicked, selfish, and corrupt to be able to live that law, and consequently it was removed from.
Okay, very good, very good. Because I do hear that. Anybody else? The official story. Okay.
A very simple. God wanted us to do it, so we did it for a while, then it was fulfilled, and so there's no more need for it, and we don't really know for sure why.
Awesome. One more woman back here. Yeah.
Well, my opinion is that...
Wait for the mic. Okay.
My opinion is perhaps it was wrong in the first place.
No, official story. I want the official... Sorry, I don't mean to cut you off, but I want the official Mormon story. Why we love polygamy?
What I would add to what has already been said in terms of the official story is that, first of all, that it was instituted to raise up a righteous nation, and secondly, that it was abandoned because God revealed to a prophet that we should no longer practice.
Very good. Okay, great. So we have some of these things floating around in our consciousness of why we lived polygamy in the first place and why it was eventually stopped and why we don't live it today. Let me see here. All right. Actually, we do have in our scriptures the reason why celestial plural marriage is no longer lived, and that's in the official Declaration 1, which you can pull up on your computer right there if you have it, and I encourage you to do so, because I'm not going to really quote it. But official Declaration 1, the first sentence, puts the whole thing in a political context. It's a response to the Utah Commission, and... he says that inasmuch as laws have been enacted forbidding plural marriage, I declare, this is Wilford Woodruff, I declare my intention to submit my advice to the LDS, or I declare my intention to submit, and my advice to the LDS is to refrain. So, interesting, not all of us look at the official declaration, but he's advising them because of politics, because it's against the law, we should refrain. So, skip. What happens if polygamy is decriminalized and, one, the church decides to go ahead and allow polygamy? That's the first scenario. I believe that that's very, very unlikely. I don't think that will happen. And two, what if the church continues to disallow it? Let's look at what happens in those two scenarios, and I think that second one is the most likely to happen. So the first thing is if the church allows it, I see a split in the membership. I believe there's some that will not live it no matter what. I want a show of hands. If you know someone, or if you are someone, who would definitely refuse to live the law of polygamy, even if the church went back to it, then raise your hand. Whoa, look at that. Okay, so... there's a lot of people that would refuse to live it, even if it's reinstated as a necessity to get you to the celestial kingdom. That's pretty amazing. Okay, now what if the church continues to disallow it? I feel that that's the most likely scenario. There's going to be a little bit of cognitive dissonance in those who have a testimony, because most people... realize that the early presence of the church, Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, John Taylor, and Wilford Woodruff, I won't get out my quotes, but I have them, said that you have to live the law of polygamy the law of marriage to get to the celestial kingdom. And so when I was a member of the church 25 or 30 years ago getting married, I feel that the climate was very different, that we actually thought that if polygamy was ever legalized, that the church would go back to it. And in fact, like it was a common practice, when I got married, I prayed for my testimony of polygamy, and I knew many of my friends that did the same, to give their testimony of polygamy so that in case the church ever had to go back to it, you would be okay with it. But that's not happening today. Among younger members of the church, they don't have that compunction that they have to have a testimony of polygamy. So there's a split in the church, I feel like. And it's gone over, I think, to the feeling that polygamy is no longer necessary. And we've rewritten our story now. We've rewritten our story to say that polygamy is not a celestial principle. So, I just want you to think about the three sentences that you wrote down. It's the last thing we're going to do. and see if there's anything you would need to change on your paper. Anything that we would need to change in our archetype if polygamy is now made legal. Because we have our official declaration, which says the only reason we don't live polygamy today is because it's not legal. But suddenly now it is legal. Would we have to change any of those sentences in what you wrote down in the very beginning to change our story? If anybody would have to change their little archetype, raise your hand. Okay, so why would yours need to be changed?
I just need to say that it has fulfilled for a while, but now it's, you know, now God wants us to do it again.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, so you'd have to change a little bit. If it wasn't made legal, but we can change it a little bit to make it so that God doesn't want us to live again, right?
Yes, we could alter that as well.
Most of us would have to fix that archetype a little bit in our head, right? And I feel like if polygamy is made legal, or not legal, but if it's decriminalized, then we are definitely going to have to work on our archetype, even if it's not right away. There's going to be some little chinks. There's going to be some cognitive dissonance going on. There's going to be little changes in our in the Mormon story, the archetype of polygamy. So our panel today is just giving you a head start on your cognitive dissonance.
All right, so let's take some questions from the audience.
What would be the minimum requirements for a husband in terms of support to be able to call this? I'm thinking of Joseph Smith here, who provided none of the usual benefits of marriage to the wives that he did, with exception perhaps of one. At any rate, what would stop, let's take the issue of immigration, for instance, that an individual could simply marry many wives in order to give them legal access to the United States, while performing no more of the advantages of marriage than Joseph Smith did. If none of them complained, and obviously they would not, what would be the legal aspects of having someone marry 100 women from Latin America in order to give them this right of domicile in the United States?
That's a great question, and I think it goes to the difference between decriminalization and formal legal recognition. So just as with a gay couple, right now they're working on reform of immigration laws, but if you are a married gay couple wanting to bring a spouse from another country, Argentina, current federal law doesn't recognize same-sex marriage, so the immigration authorities say this is not something which we recognize for immigration purposes, but they still would not put these people in jail for it. Cody Brown is seeking a similar sort of status in the decriminalization, but if he had 100 spiritual marriages to 100 women from other countries, the immigration authorities would not give those any credence for purposes of immigration. What the lawsuit is seeking would be basically that the Utah AG would say, not my business as long as you're not engaged in child rape, welfare fraud, or other criminal acts.
If I may, on that particular subject, in 1985, I decided I was going to take my wives and kids and show them where I was raised in Utah. So I bought a bus, loaded everybody on the bus, and started out in Mexico. And I have a couple of Mexican wives. We got to the border, told them who we were, what we were doing. They promptly unloaded my wives and revoked their passing cards on the spot, because there was no way they were going to let anybody practicing plural marriage cross that line. It couldn't stop me, it couldn't stop the kids, but they did take two of my wives off that bus.
I'm from Washington County, and Jeff's first child was down there to great fanfare. I have a two-part question. We're going after them now for the child brides, marrying the minors. Is there any chance that there will be more emphasis paid on the welfare fraud, which I personally think is ubiquitous in the Colorado City area, and haven't heard too much about it so far? The other one is the collusion of county officials. They have known for years about the underage marriages and the welfare fraud and chose nothing to do, did nothing about it until it became politically important for them. Could the county officials be held legally responsible and the prosecutor pursued for their doing nothing all these years?
I'll take the second one first because it's easier. It's very difficult to sue government officials for not doing their jobs. And so that would be very, very difficult. Let me just, as a brief logistical, if we can get people who have questions to come and line up, that would be easy to, so if you do have a question, if you could come over here and just stand, and that would be a way to get everybody in order and make sure that we don't miss anyone. So to the second question of welfare fraud, that gets really complicated. Because these are not marriages recognized by the state, these are, for legal purposes, single moms with a lot of kids. So is it welfare fraud if somebody who is legally a single mom with a lot of kids is applying for welfare as a single mom with a lot of kids might in an urban environment who's not in full-on marriage? And an argument can be made that, at least from a legal perspective, if the marriage is not being recognized, then these are single moms, and it would not be, at least in some cases, fraudulent for the person to say, legally I'm a single mom with children, I should qualify for wife, I should qualify for these particular benefits.
On the welfare question too, I will point out that we've looked into that repeatedly, and the numbers of people receiving government assistance in those communities is not disproportionate to other communities. Regardless of whether or not they practice a certain religious belief, the government really doesn't look into that or consider that per se. But it seems to be a well-repeated claim, but when you actually look into the statistics, it's not bearing out.
He's got my video.
Okay. All right. I just wanted to make a couple comments and maybe you could respond to. First of all, the way laws are enforced with regard to religion is a little bit more nuanced, I think, than what Brother Hayden said. And there are some cases, I believe one in Florida, where practitioners of San Pedro were allowed to make animal sacrifices because it was a religious belief. I think also Native Americans in Peyote was also approved. So maybe Kaiju could comment on that. And then secondly, in Canada, they are looking at legalizing plural marriage, actually recognizing it. There's a case before the Canada courts now, quite a bit of information on the internet if you're interested in polygamists, but former polygamists from down here testify. It's been a very interesting case. And so that's a case where we might actually get polygamy legalized, although I don't think they're going to do it. But
those are great questions. So, yeah, when we go back about two decades, there was this perception in Congress that laws are being too strict to religions, and so they enact what they call the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, RFRA, and then there have been several state-level RFRAs. These have had the effect of some illegal actions which you do in the name of religion become legal, particularly things like animal sacrifice, which might be a violation of animal treatment codes, can be legal in some jurisdictions if you do this as part of your religion, and some types of drug use can be legal if you engage in this as a religious sacrament. I think a RFRA argument could be made in favor of plural marriage. It's trickier because Reynolds is still out there. I should point out, and it's complicated because I am a feminist, I don't want to encourage any sort of any sort of patriarchal system, but Reynolds is a truly evil decision. In Reynolds, the court says, we don't want to be we don't want to encourage this because this is an evil practice that people in Asia do. And literally, the court has this incredibly racist language about polygamy as something not for the enlightened people in America, the barbaric folks in Asia do this. And Reynolds, incredibly, was cited by the California Supreme Court in marriage cases, which is this incredibly progressive decision allowing gay couples to be married in California. Footnote, this won't apply to polygamous couples, see Reynolds, which is the oddest thing in the world, in this otherwise incredibly progressive decision. So there has been pushback in RFRA and other sources, and I think that I have colleagues in law who have said it's time for Reynolds to be overturned. Reynolds is a truly evil decision. And there was, what was, you stopped?
The Canadian case.
Oh, the Canadian case. So it's not just Canada. There are other jurisdictions in the world where polygamy is legal. One really interesting facet is that in worldwide, the LDS Church doesn't allow polygamy. So if you're in an African country where polygamy is legally permitted, then other Christian churches, many of them, evangelical churches, allow polygamy. The Mormon Church doesn't, and the Mormon Church is the only church that doesn't allow polygamy.
And the Community of Christ does. I believe so.
Not
really. Oh, not anymore? Okay. Oh. But don't you let people join with their
yeah,
they used to. All right. I stand corrected.
What other questions?
I think this is just a quick legal question. If, as far as using the freedom of religion to defend your case, is the fact that you're unaffiliated a problem at all? It's not. Okay, I don't have to ask that. Okay.
The belief is a belief is a belief in the
okay.
eyes of the court,
okay.
But they have limits where they can go.
And I guess one, since that was so quick, if this idea that if you had charged on bigamy and basically child rape, that you're not likely to take the case on, I mean, could you conceivably say, hey, I'm guilty of child rape, but I want to fight the bigamy as being unconstitutional law?
And that is what happened in the Green and Holm case.
We give him the mic.
That is what happened in the Green and Holm case, is because Rodney Holm was convicted of unlawful sexual conduct with a minor, or with a 16 or 17 year old, that's the legal statute, and then Tom Green was convicted of child rape and bigamy. Bigamy was charged in concert with it. The problem is that when you get to an appellate level, your argument, you may make a religious freedom argument, but the Attorney General's office or whatever government entity is, you know, fighting back against that appeal argues that the victims in these cases are minors, therefore they can't consent to anything. So it effectively shuts down the argument, no matter how the reasons maybe the bigamy on a religious freedom grounds argument is. So if you're charging with them, you typically have victims who are minors, or you have wives who are minors, and that pretty much deflates that argument. At least that's what we've seen in past cases.
So you're not charged with bigamy in the case of several wives. If you have 10 wives, that's not 9 bigamy cases. That's one? Okay.
Right.
And so if one of the...
One of the things, the Holm case was a very close call. The Utah Supreme Court split by one vote. The Chief Justice was on the dissent and wrote a case, gave him dissent, and said, "This is, you know, this comes out of Lawrence, and this is a right to intimate association." But again, this was not a good plaintiff for a test case. A few years ago, when I talked about Prop 8 and polygamy and legal issues, and Ann Wild was in the audience, and she said, "What do we need to do to move the ball forward?" And I said, you need a test case that doesn't involve children, because that's what's happened so far.
That's all that the attorney... and so far, that is all that the Attorney General's office has charged, or the state, the county level prosecutors. Also, in part, because if they went after everybody, there are an estimated 38,000 people who at least ascribe to a belief system that allows for polygamy in and around Utah. The huge quagmire that is created, and the state has repeatedly said this, is what are you going to do with all of those people? What are you going to do? Are you going to put them all in prison? And you talked about the welfare issue. What are you going to do then once you have all of these women and children who no longer have any kind of provider because he's doing 15 to whatever in state pen? So that is kind of why the Attorney General's office has created this policy, as it were, of how they handle bigamy and polygamy prosecutions.
There's another aspect of that. I call it open and notorious polygamy. The reason the Browns came under scrutiny is because they were embarrassing the state of Utah and the Mormon Church with the sister wives thing. The reason the Tom Green came under scrutiny is he had all these nice looking young wives being paraded around on TV, and him, the old fat, or not fat, hot daddy, individual. And that was, it really offended the morals of a lot of people, or at least they got jealous. I thought I was jealous.
we have time for one more. We have any other?
I guess this is a question directed to Kaimi.
Speak louder.
Oh, a question directed to the professor here. How likely is it that the court will split hairs here on privacy and say, you know, an intimate private relationship, which they said a sexual relationship is that, and now the pleadings are saying that a marriage relationship is this private, intimate one. Can they split the hair and say, well, a legitimate marital relationship is a private, intimate one, but an illegitimate one isn't? How likely would they split that hair?
There's a lot of ways that they could try to avoid it. I mean, I think one easy way is they could say there's no harm because you haven't been hauled into criminal court yet. And another one, as you point out, is they could say this is not a legitimate marital relationship and therefore there's no privacy right here. Those, I mean, what is the definition of legitimate marital relationship? I mean, we see this with the Perry versus Schwarzenegger case, with the gay rights cases which have been brought, where at least some organizations and courts have said this is not the same type of thing which we would normally consider a traditional marriage, and therefore we're not going to give it that way of protection. What we are seeing is an incredible societal shift. So a number of people at this point are saying, you know what, let's just get the government out. And I think that whether or not the court will respond to that societal shift depends. It's unlikely that if I had to pick the odds, it's unlikely that a Utah district judge would do this. But then it goes to the appellate court. And at that point, it's entirely possible the Court on Appeals will say, you know what, as long as the government isn't recognizing these marriages, you can hold marriage ceremonies, private marriage ceremonies, with whoever you want, and that's your own business, that's your private right of privacy. And I think that's an argument which Jonathan Turley makes, and which could, especially in today's legal environment, could carry the day.